You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Times Higher Education Issue Reviewed podcast for the issue of the 24th to the 30th of September. I'm Chris Havergal and I'm joined by reporters David Matthews, Jack Grove and Matthew Rice. In this week's issue, are universities being forced to reject research grants from medical charities because of a lack of government funding for overhead costs? We've been looking at the data. 5,000 participants gathered in Glasgow last week for Europe's largest international education fair. We'll have all the coverage from the annual conference of the European Association for International Association. And we'll be reporting on what we found when we asked academics to tell us what they pin on their office doors. But first, UK medical charities have warned that universities are being forced to reject their research grants because of a gap in government support. David, you've got the story.
That's right, yes. This comes in as we build up to the spending review, George Osborne's comprehensive spending review in November, which will decide what the research budget up until 2020 is going to be. Now, this is a bit technical, so bear with me, but when a charity, for example, Cancer Research UK, gives money to a university for a research project, it covers the direct costs of that project. It doesn't cover overheads, so things like electricity bills, staff salaries in some cases, and also all the complex equipment you need to actually invest in and the buildings you need to build in order for this activity to go ahead. Now, what's happened since about 2008 is HEFCE have actually given state support to universities in order to be able to take this money to kind of bridge the gap. But with all other state funding, that's been frozen since 2010. And what charities and universities are warning about now is that because it's been frozen and the amount of charitable money has been going up, the gap's getting bigger and bigger, and universities are having to subsidise it themselves. And what I've been told by the Association for Medical Research Charities is this is actually meaning that for some smaller charities, universities are actually having to reject their grants. It seems extraordinary, doesn't it? You actually have to be able to turn away money, but they simply cannot actually afford to take to do these projects.
So the solution is to make charities pay for the overhead costs as well. Is that possible?
Imagine this: if you go on a half marathon, would you be happy knowing that possibly your donation is going to go to fund an anonymous university's electricity bill?
I mean, perhaps not.
You're right. I mean, you can kind of see the argument, can't you? If you want research to be done and you're a donor, then there's all these other, you've got to pay the full economic costs. But that does seem a little bit churlish, perhaps, doesn't it? I mean, I was reading the Daily Mail earlier today, there's another pressure on charities there. There does seem to be a lot of stories, attacking charities for, high chief executive salaries, lots of administration costs. So I don't think that's going to happen. So what essentially charities and universities are calling on is basically the government has to make up this money.
I mean, because they've still got the money to give away, so if it's not given to UK universities, the risk presumably is that it could go overseas.
Yeah, exactly. I don't think that's an imminent threat. I don't think there's any evidence that that's happening at an increasing rate, but that's definitely the warning that's been given by those such as the Wellcome Trust. They said, we already do about a fifth of our research overseas, about a fifth of the money goes overseas, so we can choose anywhere in the world to do our research. Currently the UK science place is very good, so most of it's done here, but it doesn't have to stay that way.
Concerning times. You can read about that on pages 6 and 7 of this week's magazine. Also in the magazine, several pages are given over to coverage of the annual conference of the European Association for International Education. Jack, you were there in Glasgow last week. What did you hear?
Well, this is a massive event that was up in Glasgow. It was in Istanbul, Dublin, Copenhagen before. And I was sitting in some of the sessions, and you get a real sort of international cross-section of university staff and administrators, and they're all sort of networking and making connections. One session that was particularly interesting for me was about the threat to US graduate schools, which have been perceived as the jewel in the crown of US higher education. And Deborah Stewart, who is the Emeritus President of the Council of Graduate Schools. She ran this organisation, has about 600 institutions for the last 15 years. She said that she's very worried about the downturn in Chinese graduate students coming over to the US. A very high proportion, more than a third, of all overseas students are Chinese students, and the whole system's sort of been based around recruiting them, and they're very high quality students, apparently. They, particularly in engineering and sciences, these courses are very dependent on these students. They seem to be staying in China, possibly because of the economic downturn, possibly because there's better opportunities in China now. And this is something that UK universities might have to grapple with soon, but she's saying this is quite a worry. At the moment, things have been okay because the number of Indian students has gone up massively, but if that starts to tail off, then US graduate schools might have to start thinking about the courses that they're offering.
Hmm. I mean, it can certainly be felt on both sides of the Atlantic. I mean, can I ask Jack, I mean, was this a typical academic conference, or is it something a bit grander than that?
Well, I'd say most of the participants are from sort of international units, or they're there to sort of network and make connections with other universities. It's quite sort of quite commercial. Lots of the sessions are quite based towards sort of the more corporate side of things, but there's a good mix, and some of the issues, they're quite diverse. So there was one very good session on African higher education, whether Africa, with its booming population of young people, whether that's going to be a key market for international students. There was a good session on Syria and the refugee crisis and how universities should deal with students with sort of little or no documentation coming over. How should you admit them? So there's some very interesting issues there, and good to interview some academics and administrators from all across the world and sort of find out what is on their mind.
Yeah, if anything, an event of that size, I think you were saying there were about 5,000 people there, shows the sort of economic power of international higher education. Also in this week's issue, you can read about plans to pilot standardised testing in English universities to see if it could be used to measure students' learning gain, or if it could form part of the proposed teaching excellence framework. And our cover feature this week examines the life of the shy academic, and we discover that, according to Joe Moran, who's Professor of English and Cultural Studies at Liverpool John Moores University, introversion can have its compensations. But finally, please come in, I am already disturbed. This is the sign on an office at Ulster University, but it's also the impetus for a feature in this week's magazine. Matthew, you asked academics to send you examples of what was pinned on their door, or indeed what was pinned on their colleagues' doors. What did you find?
Well, we found some really great variety of things, some very welcoming, some sort of laying down the law in effect and making clear that they were particularly pedantic and they weren't going to put up with any grammatical errors, some, as you said, discouraging students from knocking on their doors unless they really needed to, other very welcoming, jokey, and some rather mysterious. One, somebody reported a so-called Nietzschean lecturer who he'd come across, who put on his door, "I am not a man, I am dynamite." somebody reported a plastic lizard, which was stick-on lizard, which was on his door. He couldn't quite remember why it was there, but he thought it was just a discussion he'd once had with a student about medieval zoos. Somebody put some elephant on a string, I think, as a sort of locating device so that students would have an easy way of remembering where his or her office was. And so on. So there's quite a variety of things, and sometimes people use it to kind of express quite deep things. Somebody put a picture of a sunflower on their door, not only because Alan Turing was very interested in plant formations and he was a great hero of hers, but she was very keen in She was a computer scientist, but very much wanted to work in this kind of interdisciplinary area and just remind herself, encourage herself that this is quite difficult to do, but is worth pursuing.
I mean, can I ask, beyond showing the sort of huge eccentricity we can sometimes find in universities, were there sort of particular themes or issues which academics tended to base whatever they put on their doors around?
Well, I think some were one way or another celebrating their subject or their discipline. You know, classicists often put out cartoons relating to the classics, and of course with the crisis in Greece there are quite a lot around at the moment. Some kind of expressed their values. There was a woman who put up on her door the results of a research project which basically looked at the different adjectives which are used to describe men and women when they're appraised or promoted. And she said it generates a lot of discussion and is kind of very central to some of the things she both believes in and teaches. And inevitably there are even some academics who are kind of experts in this field. I've discovered one academic who described himself as a super snooper who looks at the kind of contents of people's waste paper business on as how far they reveal their personality. And he had some interesting views. And I also remembered from way back that I'd once interviewed a woman who had written something about the power of corridors, which is a rather unusual research topic. But she also had some interesting remarks, which I think came in too late, so I've been able to use them in my blog about the subject.
Well, I will look forward to your future feature on the power of corridors, Matthew. But you can find that feature, as with all the content in this week's podcast, both in the magazine and online at timeshighereducation.com. Next week sees the release of the Times Higher Education World University Rankings 2015-16, so keep an eye out for them. In the meantime, keep in touch with us. We're on Twitter at Times Higher Ed. You can also find us on Facebook and LinkedIn. But that's all for this week's podcast.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.